Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Thank you, Pete, for the update. And welcome back to Grant and Danny. Hour three just underway. It is noon, which means it is time for your Beltway Blitz. Every day we talk about the teams in town you care the most about. This hour, we're going to get into the fact that in the NFL, the rule change you and I loved, the onside kick would go away and we'd have a 4th and 15 play essentially. It failed again for the second time in 2 years. It seems like the owners want absolutely nothing to do with it, Danny. But they also don't want anything to do with making it easier to come back late in games or add some excitement to football, I guess, because the onside kick is a dying entity with the rule changes of 2018. They don't seem to want to fix it, though.
It's weird to me. I mean, they've already done legislation in this league. They've changed things. When they recognize something's not exciting, when something isn't compelling, they tried to make it more compelling. This is why the NFL is king. They have been awesome at this. They have anticipated the curve in a lot of ways. Now they've been reactionary when it comes to that, you know, pass interference challenge and some of the things like that. But they have consistently tweaked and tinkered, and all these changes that people thought, oh my God, it's not football anymore. Yes, it is. This is the new normal. Everything will be fine. It doesn't take very long to get used to. I'm surprised that this didn't have more support. I really am.
Meanwhile, in the NBA, 75% of general managers voted in favor of a play-in tournament to determine playoff seeding. 25% voted in favor of a World Cup-style group stage, according to the Ringer's Kevin O'Connor. Which would be better? What do we like better? We'll get into that this hour as well. But it is time for the Blitz, and we start off on the gridiron. Michael Phillips of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Michael, we've been playing a couple clips from Jack Del Rio on the show, obviously high on Chase Young. He is not the first defensive coordinator ever to preach that his group's going to be more aggressive than the last one. What did you take out of his discussion yesterday with you guys on Zoom?
Yeah, just so great to finally have a defensive coordinator who's going to be aggressive and get to the quarterback around here. About time. I like to call Jack Del Rio. I think he's going to be a great influence. One thing that really struck me, he's been a head coach. He's coached a lot of defenses. I'm sure he has a lot of thoughts about how a defense is run, but everything he said meshes exactly with everything Ron Rivera has said so far about how he wants his defense, how he wants the alignment, how he wants the approach. I thought that was just a really good sign that certainly here's a guy who could come in and say, here's how I'd like things done. The head coach can supervise culture, but they're really on the same page about how they're going to approach this.
So it's different ways to skin the cat, right? I think of the Greg Williams style of everyone plays assignment sound and you try to limit, you know, the offense in terms of average yards and sort of that's that. Versus you still end up with the same average yards, but if you're getting zeros and then sometimes you get gouged for 10. You see what I'm saying? Like, this to me sounds like the latter, where they're going to be, quote unquote, more aggressive, which I don't mind. I think that's today's NFL. The disruptive plays are the thing you're going for more often, even if it means you give some things up. Is that your sense of it, Miguel?
Yeah, and I'm going to put words in his mouth a little bit, but there was an acknowledgement from him. Yes, the defensive line is great. Yes, they're going to get pressure on the quarterback. But the corners in the secondary probably are not good enough to sustain a great pass defense over the course of a full 16-game season. Again, he didn't directly say that. Coaches don't directly disparage their players. But he did say they have a lot of upgrading they need to do in the back seven. He said he likes the guys they brought in, the competition, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at those guys, you know, and he said, hey, Chase Young's great. Chase Young can get to the quarterback. But if the quarterback knows he will have an open hot route right away, it does not matter. And I think they may still be in that phase a little bit. So I appreciate the understanding there that this is about more than Chase Young sacking the quarterback. This is about making sure the guys in the back are doing a good enough job to buy him time to get to the quarterback and sack him.
Who's going to be the odd man out at the linebacking position? Now that you're going to a different type of defense, you know, it's hard to assign roles to those guys, but there are more players at linebacker than there are spots.
Yeah, and, you know, so certainly you start with Ryan Anderson. He's a guy who is in no man's land right now. I don't know that was where your question was headed. I think Ryan Anderson was kind of persona non grata to begin with here in this discussion, but he's certainly an odd man out. I'm really excited once we get to camp, once we get on the field, to see what they do with Khalik Hudson, the linebacker out of Michigan. He's a guy who can play a lot of positions, brings versatility to the field. You look up a Ron Rivera guy, that's who it is right there, you know. I think he could surprise some people. I think he could maybe not take a starting spot out of the gate, but I think he could get some significant snaps. He's a guy I'm watching out for.
Offensively, a lot's being counted upon. It's not hope, but you're counting on a lot of mid-round guys who are, you know, who are viewed as steals and good value for the Redskins to really step up and do some things this year. Do you think that's a something that is likely to happen, or do you think it's fool's gold?
Well, you always bet against the rookies. Yeah, you know, even Khalik Hudson, you know, the odds are he probably won't make a big impact because he was a fifth-round draft pick, you know, and the guys Grant was referring to, your Sean Dion Hamiltons of the world, you know, it's very tough for those guys to stick and make an impact long-term, you know, and get those opportunities and be able to get out there and play. That's why this is a long-term process. If you could draft fourth-rounders every year, have them come in and make an impact, teams would not need to have rebuilding cycles. They would just draft good fourth-rounders every year and play football. So, yeah, it's okay to be excited about the draft class. It's okay to be excited about the free agents. But you also got to know most of these guys will not pan out. Heck, most second-round picks don't pan out in the NFL. That's just the nature of the beast. So this will take a long time to truly get quality players through here, cycle them through at every position, build up a roster worthy of playoff contention.
Is Rivera going to be hands-off with the defense? A guy like Del Rio normally runs his own show, but Rivera by the end of last year had taken over his own play calling duties again. It seems like a waste to have him in your building and just kind of being the head coach.
Yeah, I think Rivera will be hands-on with the defense. I don't think it bothers Jack Del Rio at the moment. And, you know, we've seen a lot of head coaches roll through and be at different positions. Jim Tom Sula obviously worked with this defensive line under Jay Gruden for a while. So I don't think it's necessarily uncharted territory to have two very qualified guys, but that's why it's very important that they be on the same page, that they teach the same approach, and that, you know, the guy below the guy in charge, in this case that's Del Rio, doesn't feel like, hey, I know better, I'm going to teach these guys differently. You got to make sure they're on the same page, but I do think Rivera is going to be very hands-on with the defense. I think you'll see a lot of that.
Michael, thank you, buddy. Always appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
We'll talk soon. Let's talk some baseball, please. My buddy Todd Davis covers the Nationals, NBC Sports Washington. Todd, posturing or serious trouble when it comes to baseball players versus the owners?
It's always tricky to tell, and it seems that we go through this extreme posturing anytime there's a work stoppage, which there hasn't been for a long time. So hearing this rhetoric in public makes everybody nervous, and adding on top of that unprecedented times and situation also makes everybody nervous. Earlier this week, we had Bob Nightingale on our podcast. He said he thought there was a 95% chance there would be a regular season. We had Tyler Kepner of the New York Times yesterday. He was down to 60%. And these are guys commonly talking to owners and agents, obviously. And we heard Max Scherzer on social media loud and clear. The union is obviously very, very irritated at this point. And there is a large gap to close between the two sides in order to have any kind of baseball season this year.
Todd, one of the things I know you've been discussing recently is the potential for some new rivals for the Nats, some new rivalries in baseball. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's just, I think baseball for a while has wanted to kind of realign things and emphasize things more geographically. And if they ever get to 32 teams, they would be able to do that more and may shuffle the entire deck. But in this case, when it's East versus East, you know, we'll see a little more. It's like dealing with the Orioles, right? They put the Orioles on the schedule every year and you see the Orioles a few times, but there's not really enough there to brew things. But when you're, if you take the AL East and the NL East and really get them playing each other often, then maybe there's some potential there. And there's some extra storylines, you know, fun things like Gerrit Cole facing the Nationals and the Yankees, obviously, don't make anyone other than Yankees fans happy. So there's a lot of interesting things going on in the AL East that may become fun things if there is actually a season this year and the travel is restricted and you're playing that other division much more often than you normally would.
Todd, we had Steve Phillips on earlier and he kind of presented things, I would say, from the owner's perspective and some things I hadn't really thought of, to be honest with you. And it was a good discussion. Can you make the case, and if you're willing to do so, why the owners have a point here when it comes to these negotiations? Because Grant and I think both, I don't want to speak for him, have both said, hey, we're very sympathetic to the players' plight of this thing when they're the ones putting their bodies on the line, putting themselves at elevated risk, depends on your perspective, but in terms of the prorated salary already agreed to, et cetera, can you make the case for the owners?
I'm very hard-pressed to do that, Danny, because this, at its core, is an employee-employer relationship, and the employer here in their proposal wants the guarantees, and that would be reduced pay for the employees no matter what happens, right? They want to be assured of that, and they want the guarantee of their own safety too. They're not going to be on the field, so where there's a dual health threat, one is the coronavirus pandemic, the second is the typical health threat of you need your body working well in order to be a top-tier athlete, right? So they're asking the players to assume both of those threats, to take way less money, and then to possibly recoup the money in the end if there is a postseason, which we don't know if there will be, because if there's another spike and that shuts down the postseason, then there goes all the players' money. But the owners got their money anyway, and they never risked anything. So I don't really see a path to make a case for ownership right now in this situation. They're going to have to give much more than they've initially offered. It's not that surprising in negotiations. Obviously, everyone's going to start on the low end. But in this case, they know what they offered is a complete non-starter, and now they've done it twice, which doesn't bode well for what's coming up here in the next week or so.
Todd Dybas, great information. Check out his work, NBC Sports Washington, joining us on the Beltway Blitz. We appreciate you, buddy.
Thanks, bud.
Thanks, guys.
We're Grant and Danny. You're listening to The Fan. Two items out of the NFL to kick around next. The first, speaking of kicks, onside kicks are staying. No 4th and 15 change coming. And second, there is another addition to the number of players who can come back from injured reserve. But why can't all players come back? I'll ask that question to Danny next on The Fan. In just over 40 minutes at 1 o'clock, Albert Breer of MMQB and SI stops by the show at 1 o'clock, latest on the NFL. And at 1:30 today, we continue our new series, Checking In. We've done it each day this week. It's a segment where we just chat with somebody from the radio station staff that you listen to day in and day out about how their show and how their time during this pandemic is going. JP Flame from The Junk joins us at 1:30 today. I wanted to get JP on, Danny, because we wanted to ask him about the NBA's return. He's a big basketball guy, and there's going to be an announcement today on some of their plans. Looks like they could be playing at Disney, which is super creative and could be pretty neat to watch. So we'll talk with him next hour about all of that.
Nice.
You called this, though. You said that you didn't think owners would approve the change to get rid of the onside kicks and to start having a 4th and 15 play from your own 25-yard line. I love this idea. It takes away the onside kick, which nobody recovers anymore anyway, and it's become increasingly difficult to actually maintain possession of the football during a comeback scenario at the end of the game. And it would create a really exciting play that you have, that you don't get in every single game, and now you might get more often. I mean, the league-wide success rate has been cut in half. 10.6% of onside kicks over the last two seasons have been recovered. 12 of 113 onside kicks. But owners have decided that they're okay with that. They're sticking with the onside kick rule over 4th and 15 and that dramatic play that would have been, you know, a do-or-die moment for teams. I think it was a mistake, but we kind of saw it coming.
No, we did. And I'm trying to understand from the owner's perspective here. Is it just that it feels too arcadey? Is it just that it feels too arena football-y or something that's not always kind of been in the NFL? Is it a bridge too far because it's too gimmicky? I'm trying to figure out why the disdain for it, why it didn't get more support in this case. Because to me, here's what it does. It takes something that's, when you know it's coming, almost a zero-sum game at this point. It's like the extra point was 98%, 99% automatic, and they said, well, let's make it less automatic, and they moved it back. This is making it less automatic. It's not as if 4th and 15s, when everybody knows it's coming, are guaranteed conversions. This isn't a fake punt in your own territory that nobody sees coming. This is an obvious, huge moment where a team is desperate. If a team is desperate and they're onside kicking, they don't have a chance to come back. To me, this, you're basically saying excitement versus not excitement. Kneel downs, running out the clock versus not that. I would always take the full 60 minutes of excitement and give a team more of a heartbeat to come back, even if it meant that, you know, the team that rightfully should win, that was better for 50 minutes, 55 minutes or whatever, doesn't necessarily win each week. It adds to the intrigue of the league, and that to me is what this whole thing's all about. It is entertainment. Non-Redskins division, the league is about entertainment for me.
Here's something I also don't get about the way they did this. And I don't know if this was just this year because of the virtual nature of the meeting or if this is something they always do, but they never even voted on this. They tabled it like they did the Rooney Rule things of a couple weeks ago that we've been talking about because of a straw poll that was done where they didn't have a majority. So they did what sounds to me like a vote, basically, informally. They did this straw poll that produced a 16-16 tie. So the proposal didn't even get to get voted on. It was just what they call tabled. Just vote on it. Like, what is the point of the straw poll before the vote? If this is up for vote, then vote on it. Why are we calling around to get a number before we actually have the vote? Everyone should just vote on this, and if it's 16-16 at that point, then table it. And if it's 15-17, then it failed. Or if it's 17-15, it needs to reach a certain threshold, then it failed. But I don't understand the straw poll element and not actually having a formal vote on this, but that's just something about the league's business that I don't really get. One other thing I would add is this. The point of an onside kick, most of the time, because we've mostly now gotten rid of the surprise onside kick as it is, mm-hmm. is so that if you're losing a game with a couple minutes less, you have a chance to win. You don't want to turn off the TV knowing your team is cooked. Because with a minute 56 to go getting the ball back, they're down by 9 or 10 points. You want to think that they can go score, get the onside kick, and go back and get the ball back and win, right? In the last 2 years since this rule change, the new kickoff rule with the new onside kick with the changes, over the past two seasons has seen 104 teams at the end of games try an onside kick. Those teams lost all 104 times. Isn't that enough evidence if you're an owner to say we should consider something else? Don't you want the possibility of a crazy outcome, of a fun comeback, of this amazing renaissance where a team was left for dead in the water and like Shredder punched through the ground to come back up from the swamp? I mean, you can't come back right now with these rules. So as of 4 or 5 minutes left, you might as well just go to the next game or turn off the TV or check your DVR for the race if you're Thommy. You can't score, get the ball on the onside kick, and score again. It hadn't happened in 2 years, 104 times, 0% of the time. That so would be enough as an owner for me to make a change.
However the math works out, right, if your team's out of timeouts and the other team that's winning recovers the onside kick, which happens over 90% of the time for the most part when they know it's coming. And I think the percentage is even higher than that when teams are telegraphed and they know that the onside kick is coming versus the surprise variety, right? You now know that last couple of minutes of the game are not must watch. You have basically telegraphed that because it's kneel down. So 42nd play clock, you multiply that times three, and between third and fourth down, you know those guys are going to rush onto the field and shake hands, and that'll be that. You can go to the next telecast.
Right.
Someone doesn't have to watch that. The NFL is the best because you have to watch every single second for fantasy purposes, for your team rooting purposes. Everything about the NFL is exciting, right? Baseball is facing a challenge, and the commissioner, I give him credit for this, by the way, he's trying to eliminate. Everybody focuses on, well, time of game, time of game, time of game. It's not necessarily time of game. If something's happening that's exciting throughout the game, people will deal with it. Mound meetings are not exciting. They're just not. I'm sorry. Four-pitch intentional walks, not exciting. I'm sorry. That's the thing that's getting cut. Baseball's trying to find a way to make themselves more like the NFL for our short attention span society. You've got something now where you're basically saying what should be the deciding moments of a game are no longer. That would be alarming to me as an owner, but it doesn't seem to be to them. I don't know what I'm missing about this.
I don't think you're missing anything. I just think you and I, who are in agreement here, are opposite the owners who have just decided that they don't want to allow for major changes to make the game feel gimmicky. And I'd admit that this is kind of archaic. You know, I had a buddy who's a huge football fan, our age, by the way, young guy, graduated a year ahead of me. And he texted me and said, this just feels like a video game. To just get the ball fourth and 15 for one play after you score a touchdown to try to go make it, take it. I don't completely disagree with that necessarily, but I think it's exciting. I think it's more fun than an onside kick. Do you enjoy watching onside kicks? Was kind of my rebuttal to him. We've gone in the last 2 years since changing the rules from onside kicks being recovered about 21% of the time to being recovered about 10% of the time. I just don't know that they're doing any good for anybody. The other thing that the NFL was voting on and actually did pass was that they've added another IR return spot. So follow me here for a second. For a long time, when you were placed on injured reserve, your season ended. So if you were hurt, you were just hurt. You couldn't play for weeks. That was okay. You could potentially be put on, you know, a list, but basically you were just recovering and you were part of the active roster. The NFL then said, okay, you could go on injured reserve if you're hurt seriously and you're out for the entire year. They've allowed for one player, when I was on the beat years ago, to come back from IR. That was their big decision. So you'd put a guy on IR, he wouldn't count against your roster, and then you'd bring that guy back after 8 weeks. Then they had two players that could be brought back. Well, they voted yesterday to expand that now to three players who can be brought back. What I don't get and what I don't understand is, why can't everybody return when they get healthy? Why does anybody have to be ruled out for the entire season on injured reserve? You know, a lot of the guys that end up on IR early and midway through the year, they could come back weeks from then. But teams just don't want to have to deal with having those players take up 53-man roster spots. In baseball, when someone gets hurt, it was the DL, now it's the IL, they go on the IL and they don't count against the roster. I don't understand why that can't be the case in the NFL, where you're able to pluck a guy up off your practice squad, a la the minor leagues in baseball, put someone on the injured list, and you expand the rosters by a player, so to speak, because this player is now hurt. We do it in every sport but football. I texted a longtime former league executive about this on the team side, and they said, I agree with you, but I would guess that what the owners would say is that it's a competitive balance thing, that they don't want, you know, players to stash guys and to have extra good players. To me, we've gone from 0 to 1, from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3. Clearly this is working. Clearly the teams like it, right? We're going very rapidly in a direction. I would just open it wide up, Danny, and say when you're put on the injured list, you get replaced by a P-squad player. The P-squad can get replaced by a player on waivers off the street. And we do it like all the other sports.
Again, that's another one I don't get what I don't get. I think it's just an expense thing, a bookkeeping thing for owners. But you're right. The trend is definitely one direction. Instead of just, you know, knocking down the wall.
Do you agree that they should do it that way? Or do you like the way they do it now?
Of course they should. It's bizarre that they do it this way. Where a guy's hurt, you have to figure out how hurt he's going to be in 2 months. That's dumb. That's not how things work anywhere, ever, you know? Like,
right. I get healthy and I'm out for the year because someone had to dictate how this was going to go as soon as I got hurt.
Yeah,
like, in other sports,
injury,
when I get healthy, I start playing again. I can't do that in football.
It must be some sort of bookkeeping, cash flow kind of situation that I don't understand. But you're right. Instead of knocking down the wall, they're just like slightly pushing it back an inch at a time. Instead of just take a sledgehammer to it. Home improvement style. Knock it down.
The NFL has made one big rule change and didn't make one of the changes that we were hoping for. You can react to those decisions at 800-636-1067 next, if you'd like, on Grant and Danny. Plus, Alex Ovechkin has once again, for a third straight NHL record, ninth time overall, won the Maurice Rocket Richard Trophy. We'll give him a little credit for that next. Movie Club is at 12:45. With the NHL regular season deemed over by Commissioner Gary Bettman, you can add another Rocket Richard Trophy to Alex Ovechkin's mantle. He tied for the NHL's league lead in goals at 48, right at the top of the board. It'll be the third straight year that he has won the Rocket Richard Trophy and the ninth time in his career, that trophy given out for the league's leading goal scorer. Here, I guess, is my frustration. And I want everyone to just put their sports hats on now, because I'm not talking about this from the context of 100,000 people dying or the economy falling apart and people losing jobs. But man, is it annoying to me, and does it just crush me, that Ovi missed out on what would have been potentially his second greatest goal-scoring season ever at 34 years old. It's incredible what he was doing. He was on pace to score 50 goals, maybe in the next game he played. He could have scored a couple. But to shatter the numbers he's posted every single year since 2008, I mean, you're going back almost 12 years ago, Danny. I wonder if people who are kind of casually following the Caps get this. He had 65 goals, which just isn't done in this era, in 07-08. And he'll never do that again, obviously. And I don't know when the next time we'll see someone score 65 goals is. Heck, I might not, to be completely honest with you, if they don't change some rules. But he was on pace for 57 goals this year. 57! The second highest total of his legendary career, and that was taken away from us. So even just if he stuck to the pace he was on, nine more goals toward hunting down Wayne Gretzky, the chase to become the all-time leading goal scorer again takes another hit. He already missed 1 year from a work stoppage, another half season from a work stoppage, now kind of a pandemic-related work stoppage. But, man, Alex Ovechkin, you feel for the guy because he was on his way to having one of the most impressive late-career seasons anybody's ever turned in sports.
Yeah, if he finishes nine goals shy of Wayne Gretzky, you'll just go, damn it. It was that one. Or, as you mentioned, the work stoppage. I mean, everything has been put in his way. And I'll maintain this. I know it's a homer take. That's the greatest goal scorer of all time. He's doing this. And again, we comp some of these things. So bear with me. When people, incorrect youngsters who want to tell me that Kobe or LeBron James are better than Michael Jordan, when they're scoring 30 a game now, and they look at some of the scoring totals, when teams are scoring 120 a game, it ain't the same as when they're scoring 86 a game because the game was different. Jordan's putting up 33 points a game when nobody was scoring. Hockey did it reverse order. In the 80s, it's a 6-5 contest. It's, everyone's going up and down, and it's skating, and everyone's open, and it's, you know, Yuri Curry and Mark Messier and Paul Coffey, and it's people are flying up and down the ice. Then they decided to make it harder to score. It's harder to score than it's ever been. And here he is putting up similar totals to what guys were doing in the 80s and early 90s. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely incredible. I was wrong in 2016, 2017. I go, well, this is the beginning of the end. He'll slow down, be in the 30-goal kind of range for a few years. Still a very helpful player. Still really good. But, you know, the days of those big, bold numbers on the hockey reference page are over. So completely incorrect about that, by the way. Just as incorrect as you could possibly be is what I was. Ringing the bell for 49, 51, 48 again this year on pace for well over 50, as you kind of touched on. It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. And I'm with you. I'm annoyed about it, too.
Yeah, it's just you throw it on the pile. From a sports standpoint, in terms of the things that we got robbed of, if you care about hockey or the Capitals at all, that might be right near the top of the list. Here's an amazing little nugget I kind of dug up looking at the numbers last night on his goals. So Ovechkin had not led the league in even strength goals since 2015, and he's only done it one time since 2010. He was leading the league in even strength goals this year. So what does that mean exactly? Well, he is prodigious on the power play, and this does not knock what he does or take away from what he does, okay? But he could, I really believe this, on the power play, his office, what they call his office, is the faceoff dot in the circle to the left side of the net. And he stands there and he just slaps one-timers 100 miles an hour past unsuspecting goaltenders, and if they are suspecting, they can't do anything about it. And he scores on average right around, I would say, 17 to 20, 20-plus goals sometimes a year on the power play. This year, he only had 13 of his 48 goals on the power play through 68 games. 35 of those goals were at even strength. He has had 50-plus goal seasons where he hasn't scored 30 goals on the power play. In the prime of his at even strength, I should say, in the prime of his career. 35 of those goals. So you're taking away empty netters. You're taking away some of those things. We're at even strength for Alex Ovechkin. Really amazing, Danny, when you start to consider, you know, what he was doing skating at even strength this year. He seems to be getting better. Now, will this slow him down? I mean, we've bet against him, as you just pointed out, in the past. Another year older, not skating for a little while. I don't know, but I'm done saying Alex Ovechkin is going to start winding it down. I'm not going to be wrong betting against him again. The next time I'll be wrong on Ovi, we'll be assuming that he doesn't hit a wall, and he will.
Yeah, well, because he's 42, at some point it's gonna and I'll happen. Predict 50 goals, right?
Right.
That'll be the time I'm wrong. Never again. I'm with you, dude.
But remember, if he doesn't get to Gretzky, and he's not ultimately considered the goal scorer of all time, the guy doing that, that he didn't get to play a season because of a lockout. He missed part of another season because of a lockout. You know, had a 48-game season, as an example, and now he missed 9 goals potentially in this pandemic. So you add all that up, you're closing in on basically 2 seasons of hockey that were taken away from him, and he still got a chance to catch a guy that was considered uncatchable.
To me, the 800-goal plateau is that's the thing. That's the big deal. I'm less concerned with catching Gretzky than I am with kind of getting past Jagr, which would be personally very meaningful to me because I still have a dark place in my soul for Jaromir Jagr for a million reasons, which I think a lot of Caps fans can relate to. But getting to 800, I think, would just be the most absurd thing, right? Yeah, you would need incredible good fortune to then add basically 100 goals to that total once again to get to Gretzky. Who knows how the math works out for a player that, as you kind of said, is at some point going to run into a skill set wall. This isn't quarterback in the NFL where you can't get touched anymore. This is the NHL, which is rough and tumble and doesn't slow down for anybody. But man, oh man, it's just remarkable where he is now, passing Messier this year, passing Yzerman this year, passing Lemieux this year. Just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Gartner's in his sights. He was too shy of Gartner, would have passed Gartner before the end of this season with a chance to catch Phil Esposito, who played for 18 years in that high goal era at 717. He's sitting right there at 706. Just absolutely amazing.
Brendan, I believe, is putting together the list of movies that we will consider watching for the weekend. Last night, we chose a movie off Danny's list, and shocker, it was another Star Wars movie. Danny's going to hate what I have to tell him next on Grant and Danny right here on The Fan. We'll be busy in the final hour. Albert Breer on the NFL at 1. J.P. Flame on the return of basketball for checking in. The latest junkie to join us. Chad started the whole week off talking with different members, colleagues of our staff that we don't get to see anymore. That's at 1:30 today. All right, so Movie Club. Danny, how do you want to do this? Last night we watched Star Wars Episode 6. I believe, let's see, this was, I get the two names confused all the time. This was Return of the Jedi, not Empire Strikes
Back. It
was
Return of the Jedi. Well done.
So do you want my thoughts? Do I want to give you this floor here to just tell us about the movie? What do you want to do?
I'll just go super quickly, and then you can pour rain all over our parade here. So this is an interesting film. It's the worst of the original trilogy, I think, and a lot of, you know, movie critics and people that love these things would tend to agree. I think the Ewoks were a little bit hokey, and it felt like they're just there to sell some toys. But you still see the ultimate growth of Mark Hamill, a.k.a. Luke Skywalker, from whiny child, bitching and moaning on Tatooine, to full-fledged Jedi. You see the Emperor. You see Darth Vader, a.k.a. Anakin Skywalker's ultimate decision to redeem himself and save his son. You see the excellent second Death Star battle. You're basically your finale. You're kind of just rising action. Doesn't take place very long, and the conclusion is basically the last hour of the movie as the assault on the shield generator takes place on the moon of Endor. All the characters come to life, and you get a nice resolution there with the destruction of that Death Star. Still incredible, still awe-inspiring, still perfect, still wondrous and just beautiful when you talk about real live action instead of CGI bullcrap. Princess Leia in the Gold Bikini. A great movie, but not as great as Empire. Certainly not as great as the original Star Wars, A New Hope. I turn it over to you, GP.
So you know that each of the first two Star Wars experiences that we had, I came away happy that I watched those movies and thinking they were pretty good. And I think I gave reasonable breakdowns. Fair?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't like this movie at all. And had you not have spoken before me, I thought this was a scalding take. I've always thought Return of the Jedi was the movie everyone says is the best one. And I liked the second one best, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, that's the best movie, right? Putting aside sort of nostalgia
and joy. So I confused the two. Because I thought going in, for some reason, the whole time I'm watching it last night, I was thinking, this is the one the Star Wars fans always talk about. And I thought that it was really, really boring for most of the movie. Couple things. So where should I begin here? You mentioned, so I'll just start here, that Carrie Fisher, the bikini where she's being held by Jabba the Hutt. I had no idea she ever averaged a triple-double. But 27 points, 17 rebounds, and 16 assists.
Oh, buddy. Every nerd's fantasy.
So we'll start there. Jabba the Hutt, love that character. I just the big, lazy, kind of my 1,000-pound life, can't get out of my bed. I like that guy. A lot of the takes that I had early on about characters that you completely shot down have been proven 100% correct and completely cemented.
Still wrong.
Absolutely cemented. Chewbacca cementing himself as useless, getting them trapped in the net again last night. Whoopsie-doopsie, ruined everything again. I'm just waiting for him to do something productive. There's been a moment in three movies where he's been helpful. Chewbacca, utterly overrated, number one. Number two, I told you a couple movies ago that Darth Vader, a completely pleasant villain, a guy that I'm not worried about at all. I'm not the least bit scared of Darth Vader at any point. He's whiny this whole movie. We take off his mask. He's a big, fat, white makeup, weird-looking guy who just, I'm so sorry, son, I saved you from the bad guy. Of course you saved him from the bad guy. You're not evil. You couldn't kill this nerd for the last three movies. Darth Vader, not a good villain. And I would go as far as to say my original point, Danny, of him not even being worthy of being scared about, completely correct, proven last night.
Nothing you've ever said ever is more wrong than that. That's the greatest villain of all time, and everybody knows it. That's just so bizarre.
The greatest villain of all time who wanted to kill one person for two movies and somehow couldn't figure it out when he was a nerd with a stick. Okay,
well, he didn't want to kill him. He literally had the proposal to not kill him. He turned the Emperor into the idea of, like, let's bring him over onto our side. And it's his son,
which
obviously
is why I never feared him, because he was never actually going to do anything bad. Let's go to R2-D2. I'd like to get positive, if you would allow, for a moment. R2-D2 is excellent. That's the small white and blue robot, for those of you that don't know. He gets no credit. He is so underrated. He's the best of the bunch. He's the hero of the whole deal. Without him, they're all lost. R2-D2, the best of the characters, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of overall, like, effectiveness at accomplishing these missions. What else? I only have one more take, and it'll also annoy you. I cannot believe how little involvement there are for some of these characters and how, I don't want to say small their roles are, but, like, I keep waiting for these moments that make you love a character. It would be the equivalent of me going back and watching all the footage of Michael Jordan's career and finding out, like, he averaged 9 points and 8 rebounds and was just kind of another guy with some of these characters. Was Boba Fett in the movie for a minute? I mean, have we seen him before this?
Yeah. He was in Empire.
Was he in the last movie?
Yeah, he was instrumental in Empire Strikes Back.
Okay,
so he was the guy that took Han Solo. He was the guy that chased them down. All these other bounty hunters couldn't do it.
Right.
And he did it. So you recognize that he's amazing.
So he's in this movie for 6 minutes. So one movie in 6 minutes out of three movies. Just some of the main characters, like Jabba the Hutt. I've heard about Jabba the Hutt since I was 5 years old. I had a buddy of mine was nicknamed Jabba. He sits there for 10 minutes in this movie and 6 minutes in the last movie. He's on screen for 17 minutes in this series. We still have toys of this guy 40 years later? I cannot believe that.
I can't believe it.
I like that guy. Really? We're like, this is the guy? This is it? Any of these characters other than the main Wizard of Oz 4 that walk down the yellow brick road, if you're Chewie, if you're Han Solo, if you're Leia, if you're Luke, I understand that. The whole thing's about them. Vader, the Emperor. Anybody else who comes and goes for 16 minutes, I cannot believe the amount of like lore and aura about these characters. It is absolutely crazy to me. Also, having now finished all three movies, I liked the first two. I didn't like the third one overall for the series. All purpose, I probably got more enjoyment out of it than I would have assumed. I cannot believe this is the trilogy that like everyone has just decided they'll be 74 and still talking about. Like that they'll get a tattoo about. I cannot believe that, having watched these three movies. So that's where I'm at after last night's installment of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, none of what you said surprises me, despite its incorrectness. But you're too young, I think, because you don't know what it's like to not have it be memed and lampooned and I am your father. You knew that Darth Vader was Luke's father before the rest of the world did. When you were young, and that was the greatest reveal in cinematic history that only three people knew about. The George Lucas, Mark Hamill, and like one director basically knew that, and Hamill had this reaction in Empire that was different than what the line was. Nobody knew, and it was unbelievable. Now everybody knows, and it's mocked, it's lampooned, it's claymation, it's, you know, whatever else. And so you grew up with all those things as a backdrop instead of the actual unbelievable joy of the greatest cinematic villain of all time that was unlike anything else that anybody had ever seen. And you knew about the history, or you didn't know, rather, about the history of what Vader had done hunting down Jedi and everything else that people were voracious and hungry for, and the growth of this universe. The reason you can have a Boba Fett toy, the reason you can have a Jabba the Hutt toy sell a billion copies is because of how beautiful and incredible and detailed this three-dimensional universe was. And that's now standard. People build things that way because of Star Wars. That's the original genesis of being able to do these kinds of things, where you can just take a slice out of the history of this universe in time that we get to view through our little viewfinder and have people appreciate it. So there's no Lord of the Rings movies. There's no Game of Thrones. There's no these incredible, epic, huge fantasy things without Star Wars.
Which would be a shame, by the way, if there was no Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it would be. It's one of the great stories ever told. And the fact that we can now see it on movie. No, I know. I get your bit, but I'm refuting it.
Just think it's an indictment on the times that everything else was so awful that this was the thing. You know, and again, like some of these guys that we put on these pedestals, Luke, I heard for so many years, Luke Skywalker, I'll be the next Luke Skywalker. I want the Force. I'm just a whiny boy. And he got less that way, which is cool, but like, I'm your father. No! It's just hard for me to get past some of how cheesy it all is.
The whole point is that he goes on a journey. If he started off awesome, boring is that? You know? But we should get to the movies for this weekend. But
can I say one more thing about the movie?
Oh, of course. Sure.
And I don't know if this is, you'd have to tell me what temperature this take is. My favorite thing about this movie, my single favorite thing, were the Ewoks. They were the cutest.
Oh, of course.
Most awesome. Like, I love those. Without those Ewoks, this movie would have absolutely sucked. This movie, on a 1 to 10 scale, I would say, would have been probably like a 3 without the Ewoks. They made it a 5.5.
When there's a witness on trial, the opposing counsel basically tries to destroy the credibility of the witness. I just got you to do that. So, again, your opinion has just been rendered moot.
I'm the most sure.
The idea
anybody
that those
who
dumb
goes
puppets.
Back and watch that movie tonight if you haven't watched it in 20 years and you tell me it's good. I'm not telling you to do it. I'm telling whoever's listening. That would be what the witness would tell you.
And everybody knows that the Ewoks are the worst part. What they should have been was a planet of Wookiees, but they couldn't figure out how to do it. That's quite literally what happened. So they decided, we'll do a cutesy thing like,
Dude, I loved it. Their little voices like, walking around, helping Princess Leia, whacking stormtroopers in the knee. Oh, it was adorable. I loved that. If I could go to some kind of pet store and buy an Ewok today for a large amount of money, I would do it. I thought it was great. Those little guys, they remind me of little French bulldogs helping out Princess Leia. It was just a 10. Mm. That was the highlight of the movie. Otherwise, it was a tough night for your boy. Good thing there was a NASCAR rain delay. I got to watch half of it then and then suffered through the other half late into the evening.
Yeah, thank goodness.
I don't know. We still got more to watch, the newer ones. Maybe I'll like those better, the Darth Maul one or whatever.
I'm sure you will, because there's more CGI.
On the Fan, and maybe the graphics are better. They've been improving with each film, I'll give it that. We're going to have to pick our movie to watch for this weekend later because we're out of time. Albert Breer is next.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.